From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 380, recorded live Thursday, July 11th, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support, online at telerik.com, and by franklins.net, makers of GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Jim Wang about the problems in today's web development experience.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here talking to Jim Wang, a web developer. How are you?
Great, Scott. How are you?
I am sad.
Oh, yeah? Why?
I am sad at the state of web development. Like, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. We have this amazing thing going on in the web right now. And I just feel like the tools are failing us, like, at every stage. And I know you're a big single-page app person. You're doing a lot of web development.
Yeah,
is totally. Is it just me? Am I the only person that feels this way?
I don't think you're the only one. I think a lot of us have just learned to live with it. I mean, to be honest, I you know, when you first suggested this topic to me, I thought, you know, yeah, what are my pain points? And yeah, you know, we really are behind in terms of just the quality, the developer experience. You know, I've had to work around stuff. My current setup is basically Visual Studio. And when I F5 to run my application, I switch into whatever debugging tools for the browser that I'm currently using. So I'm in an integrated development experience, so to speak, but I'm not using a lot of the functionality. And, you know, I've tried other editors. I've tried Sublime. I found that to be a little too bare metal. I really liked having keyboard shortcuts, having, for launching the browser and all that other stuff. And you can add that onto Sublime, to be honest. But since, you know, we work at Microsoft and I use Visual Studio every day, it was easier just to work around the problems that I was having.
Yeah. I think that outside the Visual Studio kind of bubble, for lack of another word, there are people who are, you know, really, really willing to customize their situation. Like, people will spend a day or more setting stuff up, getting their Sublime just right, getting their Bash RC correct.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Visual Studio people are kind of spoiled, you know. They install ReSharper or Code Rush or whatever, and they hit F5, and then they use the defaults.
Right, right. Yeah, the most I've ever done, to be honest with you, is I go with C# development settings, and then I change the settings for curly braces, turn on line numbers, and I'm pretty much good. The one interesting thing that I picked up from doing single page applications and a lot of JavaScript is now I do everything to two spaces for tabs instead of four.
Really?
Which drives the other people who work on my projects crazy. So
that's
I have C# code. Yeah, so I have C# code that is double spaced for tabs instead of the four.
You're going to get fired for that.
clock's a ticking, I guess.
Now, I use the web development settings with, it's called code only.
Yep.
Right. And that basically turns off all the toolbars, gets everything out of the way. So I'm using Visual Studio with, I think, only the standard toolbar. Because as a web guy, I want the drop down that lets me pick which browser I'm gonna launch.
Yep.
And then the feature where I could launch multiple browsers at once. And then what I end up doing is I'll have usually Chrome and IE on one, Firefox on another. I have three monitors, right?
Yep.
And then I'll have like whatever F12 tools I'm using at the time.
Gotcha.
And I spend a lot of time in the Chrome dev tools, but just depending, right? There's a bunch of Firefox extensions that I like for like rulers and stuff.
Right, right.
But no, it's pretty straightforward. But I was doing a spa application recently. Actually, I should probably show it to you sometime. It's a one pager that I did with a couple of guys on Twitter. Basically, it was like 2 a.m. and I was like, I'm going to write this app. So this guy, Stuart Beck, helped me out, and we got on Skype, and he did a lot of knockout, and I came up with the idea and laid a bunch of stuff out, and then I kind of went around, and we iterated on this. It's called keysleft.com, and it tells you how many keystrokes are left in your hands before you die.
What?
I'm totally serious. So the idea is that...
Okay.
No, like, why would you do this,
Scott? Yeah.
Well, the idea was that, actually, me and Damon Edwards had the idea on the way back from Build.
Okay.
Because we're coming back from Build and we haven't done any email in a week. And we're like, oh, this is going to suck.
Great luxury.
All these emails. And then I'm like, and I said that thing that I always say, which is, well, I've only got so many keystrokes left in my hands. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to give the gift of my keystrokes to all of these random people who've emailed me.
You need the Hansel bot, and it's like an auto reply for all your emails.
You know, auto replies are really rude, though. But you're right.
No, it's an intelligent auto reply, right? So this is not your typical auto reply. It goes through and filters through, you know, people you know, certain things that, you know, it looks for patterns, kind of generates a random thing. I'm telling you, people pay money for that service.
Everyone's email service, like Outlook or Gmail, has been trying to do that for years, and they just never work.
You know what I've heard of, though, is you can pay someone, you know, presumably in a third world country to run errands for you, right? And so you can also pay them to, you know, do stuff like pay bills. Right. I bet you could farm out your email.
Yeah, there's different sites for that.
Yeah. But
the idea of the thing is, rather than answering a technical question via email, I won't put 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 keystrokes into that.
Right.
Because it's a waste.
Yep.
One person emails me, I don't know you. But I'll write a blog post about it.
Yep.
And then I'll send them a link to that blog post. So then we said, well, gosh, how many keystrokes are left in your hands? Well, you know, you're 35 years old and you type this fast. You have X number of billion keystrokes. So then we went and did all the math. You have this many novels
right.
left in your hands. You have this many emails to your boss. What do you want to be spending your time on? You know?
Right.
Novels, emails, love letters, tweets, depends. So yep. it's really more of an educational thing. Like to think about it's your gift. You're going to give the people the gift of your keystrokes. So I was going to write the whole thing in web pages or PHP or something. And I was going to basically have a post back because I was going to have them fill out the little form of two things, your age and your words per minute.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would do the calculations on the server side. And Damien's like, that's just stupid. Right. This is clearly. Yeah. And, but it's a generational thing, right?
Yeah.
I spent 10 years doing that.
Right.
And he's like, get your head in the game. This is clearly, you know, Knockout. So Stuart and I did this thing in Knockout, and it's very verbose. Like, there's a lot of code there.
Yep.
And a lot of it's just set up.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the result, and you can see it at keysleft.com, it's really amazing. He even added a timer that updates one number that has the keystrokes count down. So after you type it in, they're decaying, right?
Like, gotcha. Yeah, that's really
just
cool.
Just to show you that. But, and then the entire page updates itself.
Right.
But man, debugging this thing is just a nightmare.
Yeah.
It's console.log, and we had to end up putting in a Knockout specific Chrome extension. None of the objects look like what I would think of as, like, when I think of objects, I think of data structures.
Mm-hmm.
But JavaScript debuggers want you to look at all the methods that have been, you know, spot welded onto the side of the JavaScript object.
Right, right. And that's also a side effect of Knockout, decorating your objects, given the way that it does the observables. So for folks not familiar with Knockout, the way it works is you have an object that you want to listen for changes on. And so the way Knockout does that it attaches a bunch of event listeners and properties. And so it can detect changes. And then you get nice things like dependency tracking. Let's say one observable property changes and you want to be notified or you want to subscribe to that change. You're able to do that. And that enables you to build a lot of really cool scenarios. But like you're saying, it ends up making your objects look really ugly, right? And so debugging is a pain. The other thing that you're probably going to run into is that once you start building a really large site, because you're creating all these additional properties and methods on the objects, you're going to start to run into performance issues. Now, to be honest, I've heard that. I haven't really had an issue. I haven't built a website of that scale, but
that's something
often
that people
cited.
Say.
Yeah, it's often cited as a reason. It's like, oh, that's why I want to go to Angular, which doesn't necessarily have this problem because they solve the problem a different way. They do straight string comparison.
Right. Now, in this example, I've got two text boxes feeding into, I think, maybe 12 outputs, I guess would
gotcha.
Be a way to put it, right?
Yep, yep.
And it's really brilliant. I mean, it's just a perfect single-page app.
Like, mm-hmm.
I'm waiting for this thing to get on Hacker News just so I can watch it scale.
Right.
Because, as I like to say, it does nothing. And if you do nothing, you can scale infinitely.
Right.
Right? It doesn't. It doesn't have anything.
Yeah.
So doing it in Knockout was a great idea. But I tried to do it in both Visual Studio 2012,
yep.
in 2013 with the new tools, and in Sublime.
Mm-hmm.
And really, no one was there to help me. Like,
yeah.
Nothing made it better. Like, you know, JS Lint at the command line was helpful. Some of the IntelliSense in Visual Studio was okay.
Yep.
Some of the autocomplete, not really intelligent, but autocomplete stuff in Sublime was useful.
Yeah.
But it's really back to the Wild West, you know? I guess I'm spoiled in a static typing kind of a way.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I find that people who love static typing tend to gravitate towards Angular more because they're familiar with, like, they hear the term dependency injection. Like, oh, cool. You know, Angular does dependency injection. And, you know, you can define, you know, this is also the TypeScript thing, right? Where you're starting to get into the field of I'm defining, you know, strongly typed classes. And, you know, I've got inheritance and polymorphism and I'm doing all these sorts of things just to try to make JavaScript into a strongly typed language, which really it isn't.
Right, right.
Not to say I'm dumping on TypeScript. I think it's great for type checking. I'm yet to be kind of, I got to go watch Anders talk at Build and figure out, you know, what the real value prop is beyond that. Cause I haven't really built a really large scale application that can take advantage of, I think, some of the benefits that it has to offer.
When I explain to people in public, like the difference between TypeScript and JavaScript and where it fits, I bring in CoffeeScript. And the example I always give is that CoffeeScript is what Ruby people wish JavaScript looked like.
Right.
Right. It's wrist friendly. It has white space. It's it's almost like a haiku. It has very expressive and clean.
Hamel style.
Clean lines. Yeah. Exactly. And then TypeScript is what a C# person wishes that JavaScript looks like.
Yeah.
You know, and that makes sense. But maybe actually take a moment and back up and juxtapose the difference in thinking between Knockout, which is an MVVM, and Angular or Ember, which is more of an MVC on the client, to those who maybe not be familiar with those things.
Yeah, sorry. So basically, you know, Knockout is the MVVM Silverlight model of model binding. So for folks who are really familiar with Silverlight and how that works, Knockout is going to be a great natural transition for you. Whereas with Angular, things are more declarative. So you end up defining a model, and then you end up having to namespace your application. So, you know, these things start to sound a little more server side. And then at that point, you know, Angular figures out what your model is like, and it's able to do string comparisons to detect changes that update your view. And basically how MVC works, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a model, you have a view, and then there's a controller that you initialize and hook up to be able to listen for those changes and make those comparisons. Mm-hmm. So it's just a different way to get the same thing done. Because you're doing simple string comparisons instead of doing event listeners, which is kind of a cleaner, more, I guess, programming friendly type of way, but you know, string comparisons are brute force. They end up being a little more performant depending on browser. But once again, I think the way I think about it is I wouldn't choose Angular just because, oh, you want to have, you know, you want to build a giant, massive, scalable application. I would wait until, you know, you really have some concrete data about your specific application before going one way or another. Cause you're going to save a lot in dev time if you know Silverlight for Knockout. Also, one thing that you didn't mention is the Knockout tooling inside of Visual Studio. How did you like that?
Yeah. So,
cause that's one big advantage, I think, in my mind of using Knockout versus Angular, because I'm a VS developer. I'm going to get, in fact, it even works for custom bindings, right? So if you define your own, basically your own custom functionality inside of Knockout, it also lights up with that. All the tooling works. You get IntelliSense, you get highlighting. And so, yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, so we got the highlighting.
Yep.
In the syntax kind of layout. So we could tell what was Knockout and what wasn't, because when you're in a page, particularly one that's a razor page, when you're really mixing, you know, you could literally mix CSS, JavaScript, HTML, and Knockout bindings, and even like a template, like a mustache or a handlebar template, all on one page.
Yeah.
You're really a polyglot programmer in one, on one file. In this case, it was just, because there was no back end.
Right.
It was just HTML and Knockout. So there was some IntelliSense, but that wasn't what I needed. Like, IntelliSense wasn't the pain point.
Right, right.
This no, ended up being a lot. So I hear what you're saying. I think it's great that that's in Visual Studio, but it was the lack of this idea of like what's going on. And I think this is where they say like IntelliSense rots the brain, where this silly little application needed to have planning involved. You know what I mean? This wasn't the kind of thing you just start writing.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
And even now, it still has some really interesting and subtle bugs. For example, on some browsers, we've got it set up where Knockout is automatically adding commas for like 1 billion. So it's like 1,000,000,000.
Gotcha.
But then other browsers, for some reason, that culture information is not coming across.
Interesting.
And then we'll just end up with just the number.
Hmm.
So there's a little bit of magic that's going on. I'm not quite clear about. And
right.
And then this is what happens also when you only test in Chrome.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? You test right. in the browser, and then you're like, oh yeah, well it mostly works, and it does.
Yeah.
But now I'm getting all now there's the million of little subtle details, like, you know, it works on an iPhone, but it doesn't really look great.
Exactly.
On an iPhone. But yeah. How do I test that? Like, where's my iPhone Chrome, you know, iPhone developer tools?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean it is definitely a challenge when, you know, I think we've come full circle. We've said, hey, we solved the, you know, the browser testing problem. You can just use jQuery, or, you know, we've got these frameworks and stuff you can depend on that just solve the problem. But it really doesn't. At the end of the day, it's your experience that matters, right? Mm-hmm. It's one thing for it to work, like you point out, but it's another thing for the experience just to be great on your device. You know, and I guess the nice thing is that we're starting to see, I guess, some browsers go away, which is less test coverage, you know, honestly, that less time you're going to have to spend to validate those browsers.
Less test coverage as far as major browser engines are concerned. But, yeah. You know, Firefox 22 came out today. Mm-hmm. We have version test. We have more testing on versions.
Exactly.
Of the same engine.
Yep. Than the different browsers themselves.
The different browsers themselves, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, maybe that's one thing that's a plus for IE, I guess, or a plus for Chrome, depending on which camp you're in. You know, mm-hmm. There's a major versions for IE, and then for Chrome, you don't have to worry about it. It's just latest for the most part.
That's true. I will say, though, that for the most part, if you write clean code, and I think that there's a renaissance in clean code right now. Mm-hmm. When Jin Yang and I redesigned my blog and my website, it's pretty much worked everywhere and pretty much looks okay.
Yeah.
And we really didn't test anywhere except IE and Chrome.
Really? Wow, that's awesome.
Like, sincerely. Just because we limited the number of CSS selectors that we did, we limited the number of... Our markup is, you know, other than some of the historical schmutz that my blog has, we've probably got, like, divs, H1 through H3, P and pre. Like, that's pretty much it. It's pretty clean.
Right.
There's not a lot going on there.
Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting balance, right? Because you're being very conscious about that. Right. Whereas I would argue it's like, it's kind of nice to be able to use the new stuff. Right. I'll give you an example I ran into recently. So I'm building a media site that requires me to upload a video file. So I'm like, oh, you know what a great way to do this is? I'll just new up my Bootstrap site. There's like nice progress bars that are styled.
Sure.
And I'll use the HTML5 file API.
Right. So drag and drop. And then you can get the automatic progress bar updating.
Right, right. And I'm also able just to do file upload from the browser, right? Because I can get that file object off of the form, right? And so this works great as long as, you know, you only test in Chrome. As soon as you go to a browser that doesn't support HTML5 file, now you're falling back to something like Flash or Silverlight. And so it's a big pain because you're like, hey, I want to use the new stuff, but then I basically doubled my work now because I could have just implemented the old thing and have been done with it as opposed to,
you know, the file upload is such a huge problem. There's actually a startup. I forgot the name of it, but
really?
It's like fileupload.io, I'm guessing.
Hmm.
But basically, what it is, and I have to look it up and I'll put it in the show notes for those who are listening.
Sounds good.
But they're a Y Combinator, or Combinator, depending on who you ask. and basically it's like common file dialogues for the web. Like, their argument is, we're going to just abstract the whole picking of a file away. And what they do is...
Thank you. Thank you.
You want that?
Yeah, I want that.
We'll find this.
And I mean,
they allow you to not only choose files off your disk, but they'll integrate into Dropbox.
Oh, really?
Or into SkyDrive, right? So you just, like, a file is a file. So it's a common file picker.
Exactly.
For the web. And this is, think about that. Like, this is yet another example where something's broken. So someone is going to use the opportunity to kind of putty over or spackle over that problem, just like jQuery spackled over browser differences.
Yeah, if you've ever tried to style an input type equals file and make that consistent across all browsers, you understand why I want this yesterday.
Well, or calendars. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, just try to get calendars right. There's an opportunity for someone to solve that problem.
Right. If anyone's listening closely, one of my interview questions that I use is implement a calendar.
Yeah, well, which calendar, right?
Exactly. So, you know, it tests two things. Number one, are you willing to drill down to solve a problem? And number two, can you actually solve the problem? So, always interesting.
So, the file upload stuff, you ended up doing what? Like, I actually, funny story before you answer that.
Yeah.
This podcast itself gets uploaded with a Silverlight control.
Oh, really? That's cool.
And because it's the easiest and most, it'll work anywhere because I always find myself all over the place and I've got a file to upload.
Mm-hmm.
And these are big files, right? These are, you know, 500-600 megs.
Yeah.
I don't really want to just select them and hit post and then
sure.
I need auto resume, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Right now, Carl Franklin, my producer, is working on rewriting that in HTML5, so I don't need to install Silverlight.
And cool.
He's having some trouble, right?
Yeah.
File upload is a hard problem to solve. It seems easy, but you add in things like auto resume and making it work anywhere.
Right,
it's no fun.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting problem to solve. I'll be 100% honest with you. This might be a little disappointing, but here's what I did.
Uh-oh.
I contracted out a vendor company to deliver me a file upload that basically was compatible with HTML5 and had a Silverlight fallback because I didn't want to go implement my Silverlight uploader.
Well,
And that's also, you know, generally speaking, I found tons of controls online that do this for you. They fall back to Flash. I mean, depending on what your standards are, some of those may be suitable.
Sure.
Us being Microsoft and us having to ship this, we had to go and build our own.
Well, and you know, that's the other thing that's the silly part of the web that hasn't been fixed yet is like clipboard APIs, right?
Yeah. We have one of our own of those as well.
Right. Like you look at like Bitly, right? Just for Bitly shortly, they use a Flash fallback when they can't access your and it's always this little one. I know this actually because I run Flashblock.
Oh, gotcha.
Right. Yeah. So Flashblock blocks Flash and Silverlight and generally just makes things better. and then you'll visit a site and you'll go, what's that little 8 pixel by 8 pixel square there that's gray with an international no over it?
Right.
Oh, that's that site's little clipboard deal.
Right, right.
In order to implement that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean,
how do we make this better though? I mean, like, there's a couple different scenarios. There's the big IDE. Like the Visual Studio IDE on one end. On the other end, you've got your VIs and your Vims and your lightweight text people who do things there and in shell scripts.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle somewhere, you've got Sublime with package control and package installation. You've got Adobe Brackets. You've got now Meteor. There's Cloud9. So people are talking about doing an IDE entirely in JavaScript. Brackets is a great example where it's in JavaScript, but it looks like an app, right?
Yeah.
It's actually wrapped in a Windows app.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a variety of choice. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think there's a perfect solution. I actually, when I do node programming, I switch over to Sublime and I just do command line. Because for me, the nice thing about node programming is I can go cross-plat.
Right.
So it's the exact same thing. You know, I'm using Git, I'm using Sublime. It works on a Mac. It works on my PC. It's the same development experience everywhere. And so when I'm doing that, I do tend to switch back to something a little more bare metal only because, you know, I'm not losing out on any tooling benefits that I would have had, let's say, in Visual Studio.
Well, wouldn't an argument then be if your goal is cross-platform and you're doing work in Node, then to use something like Cloud9 or to use Brackets or something that's written in JavaScript? I mean, I believe that Sublime is written in C, but it's cross-platform C.
Yep.
But arguably, machines are fast enough and JavaScript is fast enough now that an editor written in JavaScript works just fine. Does that mean that apps written in JavaScript are going to be just better?
You know, I think we're on our way there. I don't know if we're completely there yet. I think there's still something to be said for, and let's say, for lack of a better term, a somewhat offline development experience.
Mm.
And generally speaking, you know, I have used Cloud9. I really love their tooling. They actually have great node debugging tools, which is something that's a little difficult to set up on your own. It takes some effort. The open source projects, Node Inspector, that used to support it have kind of been deprecated and you have to find your own alternatives. The main issue I have is twofold. The first is performance.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, it's close. It is pretty performant. It's not slow by any means.
You think about Cloud9?
Yeah, but it's not as fast as you know, a native editor like Sublime would be.
Right. But like something like Brackets where it's JavaScript, but it's local, there is an offline experience. So, I mean, that happens as well. And even like the Azure command line tools are written in JavaScript.
Yep.
They're Node, but people who write them don't know that. You know what I'm saying? Like there are starting to be a proliferation of command line tools written in JavaScript as well. And then you've got people writing Windows 8 apps in JavaScript. I guess the Mail app.
Yeah.
In Windows 8 is written in JavaScript. You can't really tell though. Like how would I know that?
Right.
I know that because someone told me.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I think I think it depends on your runtime, right? Like with the Mail app, that's going to Windows RT, right? So at the end of the day, it's executing, you know, natively inside of the Windows environment. Whereas let's say you're using Cloud9, well, your execution environment could be Chrome. It could be IE, right? Depending on how the engine performs, depending on what you have available at the time, you're going to get variances in your experience.
Right. But brackets is going to be Chromium. And
that's interesting. Yeah.
You know, that's really interesting. Yeah. The idea of like, well, let's just ship our runtime with us.
Right.
So then you've got other runtimes to think about, right? There's other languages. And if I can bring a runtime down, like imagine, I'm kind of brainstorming here, but like imagine a .NET that came down with the app itself. Like a little tiny .NET, right? Because that's kind of what V8 is, right?
Yeah.
It's this little runtime that could, that can be private, as opposed to one that's running in like C program files that I have to update every 20 minutes, like
every
JavaScript,
so often.
Like Java, like, Java update 29.
Right. Yeah. And a big component of that too is, I guess what enables that is having a good package management system, right? Like NPM or NuGet. For folks who don't know either one, it's the equivalent. In Node and the equivalent in .NET.
Right. Whether it be gems or, but then there's development level package management like NPM and NuGet. And then there's, more kind of system level.
Yeah. Like V8.
Like apt-get and co-op.
Oh, I see.
You know what I'm saying? Like updating Windows itself.
Right.
Or Chocolatey, I guess, is the equivalent now.
Gotcha.
Open source Windows apt-get. One of the other things that we should go back to was, what kinds of tooling could make web development better for everyone? Like, there's the new, so I guess they called it Browser Link is what they told me to call it in the keynote, but we think of it as codenamed Artery.
Right.
And this is Mads Christensen and friends kind of communication link between the IDE and the browser.
Yeah.
And we're going to go and talk to other people about like letting them implement that. Like that's not something that should be specific to Visual Studio. That could be in Brackets, or that could be in Meteor, or that could be in Sublime.
Right.
Or someone like a Code Rush or a ReSharper could do that as well. And I was talking to Paul Irish from Google at the Build conference. Like, I imagined that I would want an experience where I could be in Chrome or IE or Firefox, change the DOM, get it looking the way I wanted it, and then somehow say, pushback.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, because this is how you write CSS now, right? Is you fool around in the visual editor.
Yep.
And then you go back and kind of copy paste or somehow get those changes back into the CSS.
Yeah. That's in fact, that's like the dream, right? I mean, you literally just want to fiddle around and then say persist. And once you have that link between the browser and the IDE, I think a lot of those things become possible through extending on the, I guess, the base platform of Browser Link.
Right.
You can enable a lot of these really cool scenarios, besides the just, hey, refresh my page, right? I think even cooler would be if everything just live updated, right? So let's say I'm in CSS, you know, I'm editing stuff in Chrome, and then I've got a couple other browsers open. Well, now because you have the link, not only between that browser and the IDE, but the IDE is connected to the other browsers that are open, you can actually see all your CSS changes live in the different browsers as you're making them. So if something goes wrong, you see it right away. You don't end up, you know, too far down of the wrong path.
Right. We showed a demo where we were doing live reload.
Right.
And there's been live reload tools forever.
Yeah.
And the demo that we showed isn't about the live reload feature. It's about the real-time communication. So if I could keep the DOM in sync without reloading, and then I could have things like scrolling, dynamic scrolling, where I'm scrolling and it's doing that everywhere. Mads demoed filling out forms on multiple browsers at the same time.
Right.
As well.
Yeah, really, really cool scenarios. I think they alleviate a lot of pain points for developers who are conscious of the issues they're going to run into later on down the line with the different browsers. I think you'll find a lot of people just do one browser, right? Like you say, the whole dev test in Chrome. So it doesn't really, like, I think what's interesting is to talk about, you know, what kind of problems does it solve in that scenario?
Right.
You know, the fact you are going to get the persisting back, right? Which is great. So you get to play in the browser tools and then persist back CSS changes. That's obviously a great benefit. You're going to get the push the other way for automatic refresh and everything else. But I think, you know, we've built the platform and now it's just time to, you know, open it up and see what the community creates. Cause, I think the main scenarios that are really appealing to me are when you are looking at multiple browsers.
Right.
At the same time.
I also think though that I'm surprised that tools like Glimpse haven't taken off more. Like I think the guys that built Glimpse have made a client side all in JavaScript web developer or Chrome tools like Experience, with a back-end connection to the server that is really unparalleled, because they're looking at things in a holistic view.
Yep.
That there's not like the profiling that occurs on the server and then a bright line and the profiling that occurs on the client.
Right.
You know, they put those timelines together in one place, and they look at the time to first byte kind of like full life cycle. I'd like to see that in my browser. Like, it's great that they did it in JavaScript, but their dashboard is their dashboard. Like, why doesn't my browser also know about my server and what's going on in the back end? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
What if we pushed some of the profiling information from Visual Studio or from Node or from whatever all the way up into the browser and then gave that information to the browser and told me, am I spending my time on the right stuff?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I could be off here micro benchmarking little details of CSS selectors or how stuff got rendered, but I really should be spending my time on this N+1 data query on the back end that's just killing me.
Right. That, I mean, that'd be really cool. Like, if you could have almost like a live Y slow type of experience.
Yeah.
That just ties both the client and the server together.
Yeah.
I mean, Mads does a popular talk where he goes over, it's like, hey, how to optimize your web application, which most people are doing after the fact. Right. But I mean, if you do it after the fact, you run into issues, right? It's like, okay, now I'm going to go and combine and minify my CSS and my JavaScript. Oh, great. Now I uncovered an issue that, you know, I really should have been debugging earlier on when I'm not in crunch time.
Exactly. Yeah. Did you see his web developer checklist?
Yes. Definitely a great site. I mean, and in fact, his talk is based off of going through that checklist. It's a really great talk. He's done it at a couple of conferences. The one I know of for sure is Tech Days Europe in Belgium. Mm-hmm. So the recordings for that are on Channel 9. But it's a very popular talk, and Mads is a great speaker. So I highly encourage people to go check that out. A lot of great tips for making your ASP.NET website run a lot faster, a lot smoother.
Right.
And he addresses a lot of the common problems that you're going to see.
And he actually built a Chrome plugin that will run those checks as you visit from page to page, as you go from site to site. So it is a Y slow, but from a web developer's perspective about, wait, did you remember your micro formats? Did you remember your meta? And, you know, it's more of a checklist as it is a performance tool.
Very cool. I actually did not know that.
Yeah. You should check it out. We made it so if you visit web developer checklist,
I see,
in Chrome, it'll advertise the Chrome plugin.
Gotcha. Cool. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
Check that out.
Yeah, I'll check that out.
Well,
awesome.
Cool. Well, thanks for talking to me today, Jim. I appreciate it.
I had a good time, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.